美国总统拜登这个星期在民主党全国代表大会上提到中国，他说他刚刚入主白宫的时候，传统的观点是中国将不可避免地超越美国，但是现在已经没有人这么说了。拜登总统的这番话凸显了美国以及整个国际社会对于美中以及美中所代表的体制竞争的高度关注。在这一期的纵深视角节目里呢，记者燕青采访了在奥巴马时期担任负责亚太安全事务的助理国防部长的退役海军陆战队中将格雷格森。他曾经亲历越战，后来出任太平洋海军陆战队及中央司令部海军陆战队司令。格雷格森认为，民主体制有能力在最新一轮民主与专制的博弈当中走在前面。他相信美国在二战和冷战期间的经验呢，有助于控制当下国际局势不升级为热战。他也肯定了美国对中国的威慑力量能够避免战争爆发。
General Gregson, the United States, official position, as Kurt Campbell said at the, CFR event, China is the, poses the greatest, concern and some would say threat to the United States and the liberal democratic order because of the size of the country and its, the economic, power and the political, will on the part of the Chinese leadership.Which espouses a very different system from ours. So tell us a bit about what your thoughts of this, what China under its current leadership stands for our, i.e. the United States, security and for regional security and for the structure of the world.
I think China's made their intentions pretty clear. It was in the early teens, I think, when Xi Jinping declared, quote, undisputed historical sovereignty over the South China Sea, and basing it on some lines on a map that Chiang Kai-shek drew way back when. There's no...basis in international law for that. And as a matter of fact, when the Philippines took the case to the UN, to the Court of Arbitration, the Court of Arbitration came down on the side of the Philippine case. We have the events at Mischief Reef. We have the events at Scarborough Shoal when we thought the Chinese and the Philippines had both agreed to withdraw their forces from a standoff. The Philippines withdrew their forces. The Chinese didn't.The most recent activities around Second Thomas Shoal in the Philippines and the claim that China has to sovereignty over Second Thomas Shoal when it's much closer to the Philippines by far than it is to any Chinese territory. And Xi Jinping has declared frequently that Taiwan unification is part of the great Chinese rejuvenation and it's got to happen sooner rather than later. So I think that there's reason...for people to be concerned. I agree totally with what Secretary Campbell said at the CFR, and I also agree with the Department of Defense's determination that China is the, quote, pacing threat, unquote. In other words, to maintain deterrence, we have to make sure that we maintain an edge over China despite their massive building program.
That word, pacing threat,How do you explain it? Like if we were to paraphrase it.
North Korea is a threat. Iran's a threat. Russia's a threat, especially with a demonstrated threat with what they're doing in Ukraine and what they threaten to do in other places. And China's a threat. But given the massive capability of China and the rapid advancement of their capabilities and the declared positions of Chinese leadership, that's the most dangerous threat, and that's the one that we have to make sure that we can meet.
How successful are we in staying ahead of this challenge?
Well, so far so good as we sit here today, but...
In what sense?
There's no shooting war going on.
A mark of things not working anymore is an active shooting war?
Yes, that would be the worst mark of it.
There are people who see China's conduct vis-a-vis the Philippines and increasingly closer flights towards Taiwan
mm-hmm.
as China's making more progress in advancing their either tryouts of potential mm-hmm. aggression or letting the other parties know whether it's Manila or Taipei that they're ready, they could take more further actions at any time. And the United States hasn't been seen as having stepped up to, say, accompany the Philippines in their refueling missions or do more with Taiwan? What are your thoughts? Are you concerned there?
There's reason for concern. China's tactics below the level of conflict are sometimes referred to as gray zone coercion. And they're certainly visiting coercion on Taiwan. They're visiting coercion on the Philippines. The United States relations with all the countries out there, including Taiwan, have become much deeper and more extensive. The actions taken are not necessarily a direct symmetrical response to what China is doing, but there are many asymmetrical efforts, economic, diplomatic, informational, as well as military, to try and reassure our allies and make sure that we're responding appropriately to China's coercion.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see the United States do more to deter China in these areas?
Personally, yes, but I am sure that we've got very close and continuous consultation going on with all of our friends out there. The odd thing is, with all the different efforts, that economic exchanges and business continue. And so it's a complex problem. It's much more sophisticated than just driving an aircraft carrier up to somebody's beach or something. It's got to be done in a time honored phrase, a whole of government effort. We'll see where we go in the future on it.
In the Indo-Pacific theater. Are there U.S. Marines on the shores of Taiwan already helping them or working with them on short-term or longer-term?
It's been reported in reputable news organs, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, other places, that we have increased the number of trainers in Taiwan working with Taiwan's armed forces. I don't have any figures on that. I don't have any special information on it, but Taiwan was isolated from the U.S. military from 1979, if not 1972. But 1979 was the end of the military alliance with the Republic of China. Taiwan's got a lot of very highly qualified people. They've got all the capabilities to create a superb military, and what they have done is very good. They could benefit, I think, from exposure to other militaries. And we have a National Guard partnership program between the National Guard in Michigan and the Taiwan Armed Forces. And Taiwan recently sent a battalion to Michigan to train. Climate's a little different in Michigan, I guess, from Taiwan, but maybe the heat wave has fixed that. There's other things we can do potentially in the future. We could train on Guam. We've got a lot of U.S. military on Guam, and the Taiwanese would certainly be welcome there if it's diplomatically and economically possible to do that. Having some familiarity with the Marines in Japan, I suspect that if there's an opportunity to work with the Taiwanese, that they would take advantage of it. But the United States controls visits to Taiwan and all very carefully, as you can imagine.
If the United States cannot yet strike a deal with an FTA deal with Taiwan, you might think these military collaborations, could take have more hurdles in front of them.
Well, you know, you mentioned free trade agreements. Mm-hmm. We had the Platinum Iridium Standard Free Trade Agreement all created and ready to go in a Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then we backed out of our own plan because the Obama administration didn't feel that they had the political capital to take it to the Senate to get it to get it approved at the towards the end of the second Obama administration. Japan, under Prime Minister Abe, came to the rescue with the CPTPP, Comprehensive and Progressive, I think, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and said that we're holding the door open for the United States to come back. I have known a couple of our trade reps and admire the work they do, but we're in this strange spell where we're rejecting one of the things that was one of our founding principles for the liberal world order after 1945, and that was free and fair trade. I have hopes that this fever will break at some point and we'll be able to go back to creating worthy free trade agreements with like-minded nations.
Should a conflict break out, God forbid, mm-hmm. Are you confident our partners, friends, allies in Japan and South Korea will come to the aid of the United States, that there will be a coalition of democratic nations to counter any aggression, that any effort to change the status quo in a non-peaceful manner?
I'm confident with a couple of conditions, the most important being that alliances and coalitions do not happen without a lot of continuous work. It's not sufficient to reassure somebody once. It has to be continuous reassurance. It has to be demonstration that both of our countries or all of our countries are willing to put our most precious assets on the line to protect each other, and that's a profoundly human thing. One can never be reassured too much. So we have to keep doing everything we can and then find something more to do to make sure that we can do that.
Are we seeing more European presence, German, French, etc., in the waters in the Indo-Pacific? I seem to see more.
Yes, and that's rather amazing. Constant cry about Europeans freeloading on NATO and everything has proven to be profoundly wrong. They're stepping up and they're providing more support than we are. And yes, the French still consider themselves let me take still out. The French are a Pacific nation, French Polynesia. The Germans have their own historical interest in the Pacific. Plus, there's a feeling of cooperation here amongst the NATO allies with capable navies to work with the United States. Great Britain is part of the AUKUS agreement, Australia, UK, US. British ships deploying to the Pacific with American squadrons as their flight component. It's heartening in many respects. And these countries of what used to be called East Europe, when it was under Soviet domination, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Finland, have stepped up very, very strongly. Sweden joined NATO, Finland joined NATO. I mean, this is all things that were considered impossible not long ago.
But that's NATO. But that's Europe. I know there's talk of NATO coming, becoming more active, perhaps, or involved in Asia-Pacific. Do you see these countries being part of members of this democratic League of Nations in that sense, coming to assist should any conflict break out, or to help deter potential aggressors in this theater?
I see all of that, and I also see the influence that security-minded people in Europe have on economics, being able to cooperate with, across national lines and being able to maintain economic pressure on other nations.
So that is a positive sign.
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's also fragile that this continuous work is required. We can't ever say we're done with that. We got that settled. You don't have it settled. It has to be settled every day.
As we go forward and facing challenges, including in the Indo-Pacific,
mm-hmm.
what about our society that gives you confidence that we could come out ahead?
Well, I'll go back to my recruiting duty and say that being able to meet the youth of America up close and personal was a uplifting experience, even if we didn't recruit everybody we wanted to. But it was
in what sense?
Very competent folks, very competence, patriotism, dedication, astuteness, cleverness, all these things.
But in terms of getting enough numbers to staff the ranks, to staff the positions, mm-hmm. are we facing challenges? What do we have to do?
Well, we are facing challenges. We need to do some work on living conditions, barracks and things. We can do a little bit better on that. We can do better on pay. And I understand there are some bills working their way through Congress to pay our new recruits or our new officer accessions better than we're doing now. Also, it would help if we had a more clear articulation of a grand strategy of what we're trying to do. And I think that as time goes on, the government will be able to better articulate what it is that we're doing. The beginning of the Cold War was a similar type situation. We knew how to fight World War II in 1945. After other nations got nuclear weapons, we discovered that we didn't know nearly as much about what we were doing as we needed to. We had belief that we don't need a navy or an army anymore. The Air Force will do everything, and it was a little bit chaotic. We weren't making a compelling argument to ourselves about how we were going to defend America. We got better. We figured it out. What we did during the Cold War to deter Russia, to deter Soviet Union, worked because the longer we were able to deter the Soviet Union and make containment work and make deterrence work, the more the internal contradictions inside the Soviet Union took care of things. And it's when you think about the 20th century, we had a great power war from 1914 to 1918. We had another great power war from the late 30s through the 40s. We got all the way through the second half of the 20th century without another great power war. So whatever it was that we were doing and whatever it was we figured out to do, it worked. And we need to settle on a similar concept in today's situation, which is profoundly different from the Cold War. The good thing about the Cold War is it stayed cold despite a few hot conflict campaigns underneath the larger Cold War. You're not going to recreate that totally, but hopefully we can recreate enough so that the situation remains cold, quote, unquote, without becoming another conflict.
The idea of a Marine is known worldwide. It conveys a certain significance. Can you share with our audience what that role and that significance is?
One way of thinking about it is it's the Navy's foot ashore as opposed to being afloat. The role has changed a little bit over time. World War II was famous for all the amphibious operations. The Korean conflict brought another role to the Marines, that of being a force in readiness. As the law written in the 82nd Congress says, it's the Marine Corps' job to be most ready when the nation is least ready.
And when the nation is least ready, the Marine Corps needs to be the most ready.
That's what the law said that came out of the 82nd Congress in the 1950s, yes.
Does that put the Marine Corps in the most dangerous zones, in a sense?
The Marine Corps has never been known to shy away from any commitment or any conflict. So in a little bit, I guess that characterization is good.
The Marines are on the front lines in the Indo-Pacific right now, or they are other forces are just as significant?
Well, you're not going to fight without everybody there. It's got to be a joint effort. What the Marine Corps is doing now is wrestling with the problem of we're already here. We're already well within range. We need to have a posture that is widely distributed, operationally resilient, mobile, and it's got to also be armed with whatever is necessary to be able to make sure we're able to provide a capable defense. Meaning, in general terms, we need to be able to sink ships and shoot down airplanes from the beach. We want to be able to very successfully deny any enemy control of the seas adjacent to our allies.
When you say we're already here, what do you mean?
We're in Asia. We're every one of our bases is targeted, especially the ones in Japan. For years, the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, headquartered in California, was concentrating on the wars in the Middle East, and 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force was working with the Indo-Pacific. The fact that the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force now is getting solidly involved in the Pacific is absolutely essential. Deterrence is having fire departments. If you live in a city, you see fire departments all over the place. That doesn't mean you're in favor of fire. It doesn't mean that you're expecting it, but it means that you're prepared for it.
Tell us a bit about the patriotism that you that foreigners, maybe including the Chinese, don't necessarily understand that Americans feel for their country, as embodied in the Marines, how they may think about danger, contribution, sacrifice, and what needs to be done.
Well, I guess the concept to keep in mind would be that of guardian, protecting what's near and dear to the United States. We're fortunate that through whatever magic was created years ago, that we have this mystique where people like Matt Pottinger, and Ivan Canepathy, and others that were Marines retain a lot of pride in that service. So mm-hmm. Hopefully that'll continue. I think there's a bond among all the members of the military, both current and former, from volunteering to serve something much bigger than themselves. And that concept stays with you.
Going forward, what does it take for the United States to become, as a nation, to be more aware or more connected with its armed forces, including, say, the Marines, the Marine Corps families, especially since we have an all-volunteer force?
You ended on an important point. We have an all-volunteer force, but it's an all-recruited force, and it requires a significant effort. And it's not just the individual that you're looking at recruiting. You also have to explain what we're doing to their parents, their friends, to the communities they come from. I spent 5 years on recruiting duty, so I can speak with some confidence on what the effort is. People don't volunteer without an effort. It's got to be an educational effort, a persuasion effort, and it's got to be attuned to the whole community where they live. I would say that there's disadvantages to the authoritarian system, and I'd point to the early days in the Ukraine war, what happened to the Russian army. One of the jokes was that we used to think that Russia's army was the second best in the world, and then it turns out that they were the second best in Ukraine. And then with the Wagner Group and their attempted mutiny or rebellion, the joke became that the Russian army is now the second best army in Russia. In my experience with U.S. friends who used to have autocratic governments, their armed forces became much more proficient and much better as the country democratized. In a democracy, you share information, you push authority downward. In an authoritarian system, it's always one boss at the top that directs everything, and that's not warfare in the 21st century.
Do you feel once a Marine, always a Marine?
Well, that's what we all believe.
Well, thank you, General.
Thank you.